Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's class, which is to be on Isaiah 41, verses 1 to 16, to the intriguing title, The Righteous Man from the East, taken from verse 2.
Thanks, Daniel, and my dear class members. I suppose you might say we're filling in for Brother Brian tonight, who, poor soul, is lounging on the beach in the sunshine of Queensland. So, one feels sympathy. And he's left us with Isaiah. He has actually asked us that we speak about verses 1 to 16, which we won't. And he has asked us that we speak about the righteous man from the east, which we won't. But I'll tell you what we will do. We are going to do something. What I just want to do tonight, and we've got two nights, while the beach in Queensland's warm, we've got two nights, God willing. What I want to do tonight is to try and sort of put Isaiah 41 in a bit of a overview. So we're not just going to do verses 1 to 16, we're going to do verses 1 to 29. And then the next class, we'll come back and look at some detail. Alright, okay? So the hard questions come next class, I think. It means if you ask me a hard question, I can say we're going to deal with that next class. Now, James has just... You might need those doors open, boys, so you can hear properly tonight. James has read Isaiah 41. Having sat here and listened to James read Isaiah 41, what is Isaiah 41 about? We've all sat here carefully and we spent 5 minutes while James carefully read it to us. We must have got something from it. What's it about? That's very good. That's very good. If you didn't have the Oxford Bible, where would you be? Well, if you're not too sure what Isaiah 41 is about, what's Isaiah 40 about? And when I say the word about, I don't mean what do one or two verses say. What I mean is, what's the thrust of Isaiah 40? What really is Isaiah 40 getting at? We're just doing this because it's nice at some stage to come and look over the top, down and see what we're talking about. What do you think Isaiah 40 is about? Oh, that's the theme of the verse? Auntie Bad feels like grass tonight. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Isaiah 40?
And that in comparison to God. So then it's also talking about preparing for Christ, and then all flesh is grass, and then it talks about in comparison to that God who is way above everything.
Alright. And that, you say, Samuel, God is way above everything. What part of Isaiah 40 deals with that? Verse 12 right through to the end. It's almost cut in two parts, isn't it? Verses 1 to 10, 11 are quite familiar with us, and then verses 12 through to 31 are the greatness of God. But how does that fit into the context? How does that sort of fit into the whole thing of what's happening? Is it linked in with the thing? Are there just two sort of separate areas of Isaiah 40? Is that separate from Isaiah 39? Why does Isaiah 40 start the way it does? Comfort ye my people, speak ye comfortably to Jerusalem. Why does it start that way?
It's hope on the horizon.
Hope from what, Daniel?
Hope
from
the coming spread forth in the world with Christ, the prophecy of Christ coming, that there is going to be hope even as we are, as the grass is good.
Yeah, but who needed hope?
Israel.
Why? Excellent. Yeah, okay. So take that phrase at the end of verse 6 that Samuel's mentioned, nothing shall be left. Left where, Samuel?
In Judah.
In Judah, because be taken away to Babylon. And what would be an equivalent sort of expression concept in chapter 40? Yeah. Just in the first couple of verses. The concept of nothing left. Could we link that up with the part at the end of verse 2, double for all her sins? Can we say that? She hath received of the Lord's hand double for all her sins. So nothing left. And then, so Israel has received these great punishments, but then Isaiah 40 comes in and says, comfort ye my people. See? So that gives a unity. Now the reason why that's important, and Brother Brian has sort of mentioned this, you know, the usual way of Isaiah has got these so-called three parts. Chapters 1 to 39, which we could say were sort of prophetical parts. And then chapters 36, sorry, that's not right, is it? What? 5. 35, isn't it? Yeah. 36 to 39, we could call what? We could call historical. And if we took 40 through to 66, we could call that prophetical again. And I think Brother Brian would have used the phrase, did he use the phrase Deutero-Isaiah? Because often then, the second part is said to be by a second Isaiah, or third or fourth or fifth Isaiahs. Okay? And what we say is, no, that's not right. But I just mention this because you've got to be a bit careful here. When people talk about two Isaiahs, this is Isaiah 1 here, and Isaiah 2 here, what time period does Isaiah 2, do people say it refers to? Isaiah 2 was writing. What's that? That's the prophecies of, yeah. Any idea?
After
King Cyrus. Yeah, that's right. So we might say here after exile. They say this second Isaiah is after exile. Now that's why you've got to be a bit careful. If you read sort of common books on Isaiah, you can be reading something and you can sort of get the wrong idea because they are writing as though this second part was very late after exile. Right? And so you sort of read something and you think, oh yeah, that's fair enough. Then you suddenly think, oh, that's not quite right because it's in the wrong time period. What time period was the first Isaiah? I should now say the first part of Isaiah. In the days of what kings?
Isaiah, Ahaz.
Yeah, Isaiah, Ahaz, was it? And Hezekiah. And Jotham. Okay? Mainly Hezekiah, I suppose. So when you get to verses like Isaiah 7, Emmanuel, where you get to Isaiah 9, unto us a son is born, what historical basis is that on? Ahaz, you say? Ahaz. Yeah, and his son Hezekiah. It's true, isn't it? Unto us a son is born, Isaiah 9, verse 6. In the first instance, it's Hezekiah. But it's mainly about Christ. Okay? Now, what you've got to make sure that you're looking at here, and you'll see the point in a minute, when you're getting prophecies here, what historical base are they written on about? If you've got someone who suffered in Isaiah 53, what's the historical base for someone who suffered in Isaiah 53? Still Hezekiah, isn't it? So it's an historical base. So that's really why this sort of view here that puts the second Isaiah much later ruins much of this whole section here, which is still based around Hezekiah. Okay? Now, a minute ago, we gave a link between 39 and 40, didn't we? Samuel said, what did he say? Nothing shall be left. And then Isaiah 40 comes in and says, comfort ye, for Israel has received double for all their sins. So what that actually did is it put a bit of a ring around here. See? And it strings it together. In fact, the historical section is about who? Hezekiah. So you've got these rings that now link and pull the whole book together. Okay. That's an important thing. So when we really come into this section here, we should be sort of expecting it to bounce out of here, and that's exactly really what happened. That's why this thing here is wrong, because otherwise you're bouncing from here, you'd go to, what, how long later? I don't know, 150, 200 years later, and you'd bounce down to here, which wouldn't be right. Okay. Now, let's think about then it in this context. So you come out of 39, which is saying you're going to Babylon. You come into 40, which words of comfort are going to come to Israel because they're going to be restored again, and the words of the prophets then come forth. The sun had gone down on the prophets, it was now come back again, and John the Baptist comes out and says, prepare ye the way of the Lord, make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Then you've got those well-known parts there, all flesh is grass, etc. And it builds up to a climax. In verse 9, O Zion that bringeth good tidings, get thee up into the high mountain, O Jerusalem that bringeth good tidings. See, there's a change, whole change. Say unto the cities of Judah, behold your God. Who was that? Behold your God. Sorry, you might have said it, but who was he referring to? Behold your God. He's referring to the Lord Jesus Christ, isn't he? Must be. The one who showed the glory of the Father, who revealed the Father to them. My Lord and my God, says Thomas. And then it sort of pitches you ahead in verse 11, 10 and 11 to the future. Okay? Now, the God who's going to do these things, he is going to do them because he's all-powerful. Now, that's a pretty mighty request in the first part of Isaiah 40, but he's a mighty God. And that's really what the rest of chapter 40 is about. He is a mighty God who hath measured, in verse 12, who hath measured the waters in the hollow of his hands. He's got all this power. He's unique. He's got all this great authority. He's unchallengeable, so he will be able to do that restoration. Okay? And that's really the theme then that comes through. Now, let's just think about this. Get rid of this erroneous concept. Might just get rid of it all. If we now just take this section through to chapter 66, but we won't really, we'll just think about it only as far as 45 and 46, just because that's far enough. Nothing magic about that. If we take this section here, what are some of the main things which we find in that section of Isaiah? Running from 40, we've just looked at, 41, 42, 43, 44, 45, maybe 46. What are some of the main things?
Sorry?
Is there anything? Where's that? Just up here, isn't it? I think you mentioned, up here. Now, I just sort of put that aside a bit because I want to get back to that later on, next class soon. What are some of the concepts that flow through those chapters? Have a think about it. I don't mind. Sorry, I've only said 46 just because I wanted to stop somewhere, that was all. Yeah. Otherwise it's too hard, too big. Let's write that down as a major word. Servant. Where do you find that then?
42.
42. Where's that? Daniel 42.
Verse 1, behold, my servant.
Yep. Anything else? Yeah. Don't bother going right through to that. I know that that's there, but just to concentrate our search, otherwise we'll be here all night. Just think about these early chapters. And I'm not saying that it changes subject. I'm just saying, just for convenience for tonight, let's just think more about that block there, because it just carries on. Yeah, I can just write that down here a minute, because we'll just pursue the servant one for a minute, Pete. False of idols. Do that one next. Okay? Servant? Any other servants?
42:1.
Yep. Anything else? Well, I'll ask you a question. It says, who is the servant? Who is the servant? What was that, Mark?
44:1.
Well, wait, before you get on to that one there, someone else said something first. You said it's Christ.
41,
and Alex said, which chapter? And Mark said what? You said Jacob. Jacob himself? Did someone say Israel? Yeah. Do you think it's referring to Jacob as the person? No. What is it referring to as in Naomi? Yeah, it's Israel. Okay. So, there's actually a couple of servants. There's Israel and Christ. Have a guess. Which is the one that's used most commonly? Eh? Which one? Yeah, I think it's Israel, actually. Which is interesting. Now, I shall just... happen to have in my bag here. Yeah, it's a problem. When the cord's here and that's like that, would you just like to hang on to that end? You hear what Alex said? Did you? Drat. What happened was, the overhead went on and everyone started to read the overhead. Say it again, Alex.
And quite often when Israel is using the title for Israel, it's meant to indicate that Israel acting as Jacob did, when he pointed it back under his own steam rather than depending on God.
Yeah. Okay. Now, just take these here, you don't have to read, but just notice actually, in 41, it starts in 41, and but thou Israel art my servant, Jacob whom I have chosen. Thou art my servant, I have chosen thee and not cast thee away. Again referring to Israel. Behold my servant whom I uphold, my elect whom my soul delighteth, specifically the Lord Jesus Christ. Who is blind but my servant? Blind is the Lord's servant. Who's that? Israel. Ye are my witnesses, saith the Lord, and my servant whom I have chosen. Israel. Yet now hear, O Jacob, my servant, and Israel whom I have chosen. It's Israel. Fear not, O Jacob, my servant, and thou Jeshurun whom I have chosen. O Jacob and Israel, for thou art my servant, thou art my servant, O Israel. That confirmeth the word of his servant. That's one's a bit different, but for Jacob my servant's sake, and Israel mine elect. So in fact, in those first areas, it's mainly Israel's a servant. So that's a thing to think about. How is this working out then? We've got the servant being... It's going to end up with Christ, particularly Isaiah 53. But in this area here, we've got Israel. That's one thing. Let's just take another thing. And what did you say? What did you say, Pete? False idols. When do they? Where do they occur?
Well, they cropped up in the reading we read
Twenty-one to where?
24.
Yeah, I'll just write that up. 41, verse 21 to 24. Verse 29 ends up that way, doesn't it? Verse 29's got that as well. And then molten images are wind and confusion. Okay, where else in those areas in Isaiah does it refer to idols? There's a whole 12 verses in Isaiah 44. Okay? 40 verse 19 and 20. Okay? Got that? Where else? 43 verse 12. Where else? Any others? Idols.
I think 41 verse 7 is talking about
constructing
idols.
Yeah, 41 verse 7. Yep, anything else? I'll just tell it to you more. 20 and 21, Isaiah 46 verses 1 to 2 and verses 5 to 7 and so on and so on and so on, and you can keep going. So we've got Israel being a servant now, and we've got false idols. Anything else? Just forget about idols for a minute. What other subjects do we have? Yeah. Often with Jacob. Anything else? What's that? Yeah, I'm not sure. That probably occurs a bit later. I don't know. I haven't tracked that one through. Anyone? Any other suggestions? I've just got a couple more. The Holy One of Israel. To whom then will you liken me, or shall I be equal, said the Holy One? I will help thee, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Thou shalt rejoice in the Lord, and thou shalt glory in the Holy One of Israel. The hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel hath created it. For I am the Lord thy God, the Holy One of Israel. Thus saith the Lord your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. I am the Lord your Holy One, the Creator of Israel, your King. Thus saith the Lord, the Holy One of Israel. So, that's just in a few verses. Well, a few chapters. So another little expression we've got is the Holy One of Israel. Okay? One more. And this one actually goes a bit further, but I'll just do the first few here. Thy Redeemer. Thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. Thus saith the Lord your Redeemer, his Redeemer, the Lord of hosts. Thus saith the Lord thy Redeemer, as for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is his name, and so on. Now, let's have a think about this then. If we've got these, just those keywords now. Redeemer, the servant being Israel, in the main, this is the early stage, the Holy One of Israel, and false idols. What then would you say those chapters were about? If they are four recurring things, what is the span of chapters about?
Two servants,
that's taking it through into later chapters, yeah? Okay. But can I just then come back a bit? It's all about redemption of Israel, isn't it? It's the Holy One of Israel. So it's coming out of that chapter 39 where they were in captivity, and now we've got the redemption of Israel. God is the great Redeemer of Israel, who is regarded as his servant. And as Alex says, there's going to be a particular man who will actually come and do the redemption. That servant, Christ. In contrast to any thought that the false idols would achieve success. See? So just think, that's the sort of a summary then of those chapters. The Holy One of Israel, God, he's of Israel because he's going to bring Israel and deliver them. He's going to be their redeemer. He's going to redeem his servant Israel. And there is no power in the false idols. Because remember what Isaiah 40 verses 12 onwards was about? It was about the almighty power of God, in contrast to the false idols. Now, let's do some harder work. I think it's... someone like to look, give those out? Thanks. Yeah, I'd like to give those out, thanks. You'd rip a few out to the back, right? Need these next week as well, by the way, so don't throw them away. Next class. Okay, now there's nothing magic about this. Because all I've done here is written out the authorised version on the left-hand column. And from time to time I've put in some words from the New American Standard Version, not because Alec can't read the non-American stuff, but sometimes it helps. Now, the reason I've done this like this is because who understood Isaiah 41 when they read it tonight? Anyone? Why is it hard to understand? Cryptic, yeah. But actually, often it's the way it's printed that doesn't help. Because our Bible has got a lot of ink on. In these sections here, it's more poetry. So you take Alex's Bible, for example, it will actually just have it like poetry and lots of white paper. There's gaps and everything. And you can really understand it a lot easier. So what I've tried to do here... So let's just think about the authorised version. I'll just re-express it so that I've got separate lines for each little phrase, which correspond with the poetry in the New American Standard Version. Put some space in, and then try and think about what it's about. So our project now is just to think about those and you just try and work them out. Now you notice... there's a few empty boxes. There's three empty boxes across the page on page one. And there's one empty box on page two. And there's two empty boxes on page three and one empty box on page four. Okay? Now what we want to do is to write in those boxes what the following section is about. It's easy. Now we'll do it all together so it won't be too hard. Just by reading it, thinking about these things here, and hopefully making some progress. And I hope you find that this is easier than just looking at the authorised version. Once you've got the hang of this, then it's easier to put it back into your authorised version or onto your Oxford Bible. Let's start off here, the first verse. Keep silence before me, O islands. And I've got on the right-hand side that little expression, coastlands, listen to me in silence. So, instead of islands. In the AV, it's coastlands. So it's not necessarily out in the islands of the world. Keep silence before me, O islands or coastlands. Let the people renew their strength. Let them come near. Let them speak. Let us come near together in judgment. Now, what do you think is happening? Let them come near. Let them speak. Let us come near to judgment. What's sort of happening? You don't have to be right when you give an answer, by the way. Just any answer will do. May not be one right answer. What do you think is happening with those verses? Let them come near, let them speak, let us come together to judgment. And just think about where we've come from. Who's going to judge? Who's under trial?
One verse told to remain quiet in our presuming islands just like Gentiles. And in the context of the Babylonian power, which is the Gentile power of the present. And we've been keeping silent, and therefore not being opposition. The people of Judah are allowed to renew their strength, and then they come near to God.
Yeah, that's probably a bit complex, but it may be right, Sam. No, but look, can I just take a simple concept? Could we say there's going to be a trial that goes on? And it's a trial involving the nations, isn't it? And we're going to hear a case. We're going to sit down. And we're going to hear their case. Would that be right, wouldn't it? So it's a call to the Gentile nations now. He's changed his focus. Remember, he was really hotly focused on Israel. He says, now let's just sit down and let's hear what they've got to say. Could it be the gods of the Gentile nations, we could perhaps say in brackets. Let's hear what they've got to say. Okay? So you could put in the box up there something like, words something like a trial. It's a call to a judgment, call to a trial. We're going to hear the case. We're going to hear what they've got to say for themselves. Maybe it's Gentile nations that are going to say something for themselves. All right? Let's work it out. Who's boss around here, but that's a bit colloquial, but it's sort of like that, isn't it? Who's under control, we could say. So you can put those words up on the top. Okay, so let's sort out who is under control. Because don't forget, we've got the Holy One of Israel who says he's running things, isn't it? In chapter 40. Let's just see whether this is right. Now, let's just go to the next section. Who raised up the righteous man from the east and called him to his foot, gave the nations before him and made him rule over kings? Now, whatever the words actually mean, there's a question mark there, isn't there? Whether you take the authorised version on the left-hand side or the right-hand side, the New American Standard Version, it's a question mark. Who has done that? What would be the answer? Yes, yes, that's right. So here's this trial. He's saying to the Nakimon, who did that? Let's not worry too much about what the words actually mean, but that's the general impression. All right, okay. Who has done this? Who's brought this man from the east and done those works? There's only one answer, I think, because Auntie Glad says it's got to be God. It's got to be Yahweh has done that. So, and what did this person do? Well, he made a fair showing of things. He pursued, this is verse 3 now. He pursued them and passed safely. What's that mean? He pursued and passed safely. Needs to be understood. Daniel?
He had no problems.
Yeah, so he's obviously a pretty strong power who just goes pursuing everyone else and he gets away with it. Goes safe. No trouble? Even by the way, he had not gone with his feet. He hadn't been there before, but he went straight through and was successful. Who has, verse 4, who has wrought it and done it, calling them generations from the beginning? And then he gives the answer. I, Yahweh, the first and with the last, I am he. So, in other words, how can we summarise those four, three verses then? The thrust of the issue in those three verses.
God's got the
ability to have control. Yes, that's exactly right. God, and you even might say Roger has, helped Israel, isn't he, in that sense? Or at least, in this particular context, it's God that has been the driving force of some strong power. See, God has been behind it. There's been a strong power who's come out of the east. But the whole person who's in control is God. So maybe the summary is something like that God has been in control of events, or will be in control of events, depending on who's the man from the east. God's raised him up. Okay? But when this man from the east came, this mighty power, what did other people do except for Israel, outside Israel? What did they do? How did the nations, the other little nations around the place, react when this man came from the east and swept over them? Gave them as the dust to his sword and driven stubble to his bow. What did they do? What did the other people do?
They started working together and by invitation to make others.
Yeah. And why do you say that, Daniel?
Well, because of their fear. They fear because of this great power on land, and so they start
getting
together, helping each other, encouraging each other,
being good
courage,
and
so they get
busily
about this work.
Okay, alright, that's good. Can I just read it out just to take it slower? Verse 5. The isles, or you see in the right hand margin there, the coastland, so it probably could be the countries around that Mediterranean coast. They've seen and are afraid. The ends of the earth tremble. Why are they trembling? Because of this mighty power that's coming down from upon them. They have drawn near and come. That's verse 5 on the right hand side. Because they're all worried and they sort of try and get together a bit, and there's a degree of, a high degree of anxiety. Everyone helps his neighbour and says to his brother, be strong. But all they can say, and they sort of, you know, the lump in their throat, be strong. And they're trying to sort of overcome, they think they're going to sort of overcome this, but they're not going to succeed, of course, at all. But they're sort of very valiantly saying, be strong. And then they think, well, they better do something. I've got to sort of stop this fella coming from the east. And so the craftsman comes and he encourages the smelter. Well, the goldsmith, see on the left-hand side is goldsmith and the right-hand side is smelter. And then they get the one who works with metal. He smooths metal with a hammer. And he gets someone else who beats the anvil. And then they get someone else who's got the soldering iron. And they get all together. And the one with the soldering iron says, yeah, that's fine, that's good. And they make this, what do they make? An idol? It takes four of them, see. You've got to have a few people to make an idol. Four men, isn't it? The smelter, one who smooths metal with his hammer, one who beats the anvil, the one with the soldering iron. So it takes four of them, you see. Idols are a bit difficult. And then when they make the idol, what are they going to do? That's right, because it would be a shame if they, it would be a real shame if they made the idol and it fell over. So they've got to get it, get the hammer out, nail it to the floor, that it shall not fall over. So it's just the last finishing touch is to make sure this idol's worthy of their worship, and they nail it to the floor so it stands up nice and upright. And why are they doing it? Back to Samuel. Fear because of this nation coming down. Okay? Not too hard? Easy? So, in that little box above there, what could we say then? If you haven't already got something written up there, it's the nation's fearful of the invader, and they rush to find their strength in idols. But another one of these sections here, the false idols. What do we expect then when we turn the page? Where do you think the chapter will go after that? We've dealt with these Gentile nations, and all that they could do when they were put on trial, all they could say was, well, here's our idol, and bang, it's on the floor, and there it is. What do you think is going to happen next? Yeah, that could be one thing. What else do you think Isaiah might say?
Show the folly of it.
Hmm?
Show the folly of it.
Yeah?
Would Jacob would even it?
Yes. I think he might now go and say, well, how are we getting on back here with Israel? See, if that was what they were like, what about Israel? So, we turn the page. But there, Israel art my servant. See? Jacob, whom I have chosen, and the seed of Abraham my friend. So what he's going to say now is, you're different, aren't you? Why are you different? Why won't you, or why shouldn't you, be reacting like those other people reacted? Why should you be different? Why are you different? Because they've got God as the Holy One of Israel, their Redeemer, is going to look after his servant. See? So don't you worry, Israel, about this. They might do that, but you, Israel, and I'll just read through some of these verses. Thou, Israel, art my servant. You're different. Jacob, whom I have chosen, the seed of Abraham, my friend. Thou whom I have taken from the ends of the earth and called thee from the chief men thereof. Notice it says in the right hand side, the New American Standard Version, called you from the remotest parts. Now I've brought you, Abraham, developed you as a nation, and I've said to you, thou art my servant, I've chosen you. Am I going to look after you? Of course I'm going to. I'll look after you, all right? Fear not, I am with thee. Be not dismayed, for I am thy God. I don't need to be nailed to the floor. I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Over on the right hand side, I will uphold you with my righteous right hand. Bit of a little hint that there could be some special person involved in this. A righteous right hand of God. So verse 11, behold, all they that were incensed against thee shall be ashamed and confounded. They shall be as nothing, and they that strive with thee shall perish. When did the last time one of these invaders perish before them?
Egypt.
Egypt, yeah. What's that? Assyria? When? Hezekiah's done. Just a few weeks ago, or a few months ago, or something, a few years ago. They've seen it, you see? When the Syrian came down like a wolf on the fold, and his cohorts were gleaming in silver and gold, all the coastlands were afraid, but Israel, you don't need to worry, because they'll be as nothing. See? And they've had evidence before them that they didn't need any false gods. They all didn't, all they needed was the God of Israel. Verse 12. I'll just read out the right hand side. You will seek those who quarrel with you, but you will not find them. Those who war with you will be as nothing and non-existent. So, Sennacherib lost all his army in one night. Verse 13. For I, the Lord thy God, will hold thy right hand, saying unto thee, fear not, I will help thee. Fear not, thou worm Jacob. Why does he use the term worm? Don't you fear, Jacob, my worm? Why does he say worm? Worm. Hmm? Yeah. Worm. Where else is that referred to? The worm.
Psalm 22.
Psalm 22, yeah. Where it says what? Spot on, I think, isn't it? I think so. Yeah, and who's saying that? Yes. Do you all get what Daniel's saying? Psalm 22. We must have some cross-reference for the night. Make it this the one. Psalm 22 and verse... Where is it, Daniel? 6. Want to read it out?
That I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people.
And who's saying that? Or who's the psalmist saying is going to say it?
Christ,
Jesus said that. Why does he call himself a worm? For the sake of those who didn't hear your first answer.
Because of what he feels the wretchedness of his nature.
Yeah. Little. Despised. Of no account. Sort of stole all those ideas. Okay. So back in Isaiah 41. Verse 14. Fear not thou worm Jacob and ye men of Israel. You might feel as though you're only very little, but I will help you, saith the Lord, and thy Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel. See, both our phrases come here. I'm your Redeemer. I'm the Holy One of Israel. Of course I'm going to help you. Of course I'll be there. Behold, I will make thee a new sharp threshing instrument having teeth, and thou shalt thresh the mountains and beat them small, and shall make the hills of chaff. So Israel will actually be given teeth, as it were. They'll be made strong and powerful. So, you see, going from a worm in verse 14 to be this threshing instrument, sharp, new threshing instrument in verse 15, is a great transformation. God's done it. Thou shalt fan them, and the wind shall carry them away, in verse 16. And the whirlwind will scatter them, and thou shalt rejoice in Yahweh, and shall glory in, here he is again, the Holy One of Israel. So, over the page. I won't sort of stop too much on this section, we'll come back to it next week, but you can see the way things are transformed. When the poor and needy seek water, there is none, their tongue faileth for thirst. I, the Lord, will hear them. I, the God of Israel, will not forsake Israel. Of course I won't. I will open rivers in the high places and fountains in the midst of the valleys. I'll make the wilderness a pool of water and the dry land springs of water. I'll look after you. I'll plant in the wilderness the cedar, the shittah tree, and the myrtle, and the oil tree. I'll set in the desert the fir tree, and the pine, and the box tree together, that they may see and know and consider and understand together that the hand of the Lord hath done this, and the Holy One of Israel is on Israel's side. Okay? Now, we stop and think about it again. What do you think is happening in verse 21? You might need to flip your eye just through the following verses. It's quite a break there. What's happening now?
Well, from about verse 15 to 20, God is saying what he is going to do in the future to some enemies of Israel. And then verse 21 onwards, he's saying, as a challenge to the idols, can you also predict in advance what's going to happen?
Yeah, that's good, Pete. Okay. I mean, verse 21 is a bit like verse 1. Because verse 1 was this challenge. Let's get this judgment sorted out. The nation's on trial. Verse 21 is like the idols on trial, isn't it? Exactly what Pete said. Let's have a listen to them. Let's step back and I've told you some things. You tell me yours. And he has his ear. He never hears anything, he said. You go up to the idol and say, look, come on, your turn to speak. And he'd be sitting there for quite some time. So he said, bring forth your strong reasons, come on. We're waiting. Verse 22. Let them bring forth and show us what shall happen. Come on, I've just told you. Now you tell me. Well, if you don't want to say anything about the future, say something about the past. Let them show the former things then. Come on, just tell us about the former things. Still silence. That we may consider them. And we'll know the latter end of them. Still silence. Well, if you want to, tell us about things to come. We'll wait. See over on the right hand side. Or announce to us what's coming. Come on, tell us. Still silence. Verse 23. Show the things which are to come hereafter, that we may know your gods. I mean, can't be much of a god if you don't tell us that. Yea, and he says, do good or evil. He says, I don't care if you don't say anything, do something. I don't care what it is, just do something. Come on, do something. Do good or do evil. Over on the right hand side, do good or evil, anything really. That we may fear, that we may anxiously look about us and fear together. You know, at least we'll have something. But nothing's happened. See? This idol's still stuck in the ground. The nail's still there, and he's still standing there, and he's not saying a single thing. And so the prophet says, hang on a minute. Verse 24, you have nothing really, come to think of it. Your work of naught. Because you haven't done anything. He who chooses you is an abomination. Yeah. You're not good to this. So that was the idol dismissed. Well, then it sort of, does that sound all right, I'm glad? You look a bit puzzled. Yeah, that's right. And they didn't do a single thing. So, verse 25 then, we start up again, another little section. What's the significance in saying, I have raised up one from the north? Well, why does he start with those words? I have raised up one from the north. Yeah, they ain't done nothing. And now, I've done something. See, I'm in control. I'm the God of Israel, the Redeemer of Israel. I've done something. You see, that's a bit like verse 2, isn't it? Verse 2 was, who has raised up the righteous man from the east? And the implication is, well, God has done it. Well, now it says in verse 25, clearly God's in control. I've raised up one from the north. He'll come. From the rising of the sun, which is the east, shall he call upon my name. He shall come upon princes as upon mortar, and as the potter treadeth clay. Who hath declared from the beginning that we may know? The idols didn't tell us. Before time that we may say he is righteous, yea, there is none that showeth, there's none that declareth, there's none that heareth your words. Your idols aren't saying anything. The first shall say to Zion, behold, behold them, and I'll give to Jerusalem one that bringeth good tidings. I'm going to bring a deliverer, one that brings good tidings. Behold, there was no man even among them, and there was no counselor that when I asked of them could answer a word. Behold, they are all vanity, their works are nothing, their molten images are wind and confusion. I hope that's given you a bit of an overview of what the chapter's about. But you see that, just mentioned once more, it's really these ideas coming out. God is the Holy One of Israel, who's going to look after his servant Israel by getting another servant, the Lord Jesus Christ, who's going to come and the Redeemer. The idol is nothing in the world. The Apostle Paul said, wasn't it? The idol is nothing. But God is the Holy One of Israel, the Redeemer of his people. And next week we hope, God willing, to next fortnight to look at a few details about that. Thanks, Daniel.